WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. 20 years ago today, John Lennon was assassinated in the entranceway of his apartment building in New York City. 2 hours after his murder, at 1 a.m, 1,000 fans had already gathered at the site to mourn. In honor of the anniversary, we're featuring 2 interviews with the women who shared his life, Cynthia Lennon and Yoko Ono. Back in the 60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized about romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Powell held the position so many girls dreamed of. She was married to John Lennon.
Hey!
Cynthia Powell and John Lennon shared a working-class background. They met in art school in 1957 and were married in 1962. During the years that John toured the world as a member of the most popular rock group in history, Cynthia was at home raising their son Julian. Cynthia and John Lennon divorced in 1968 after John fell in love with Yoko Ono. John Lennon was killed 12 years later. As her son Julian launched his own career as a musician, Cynthia Lennon developed her work as a designer. Terry Gross spoke to Cynthia in 1985. They talked about the years she was known as a Beatle wife.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation, because in those days it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked around pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes, and in fact, I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, no, I'm somebody else.
Did John feel at all uncomfortable telling his wife not to act like his wife?
Well, it wasn't a sort of husband-wife situation, really. You know, again, it's very hard to describe, because we had a son on the way, and we were married very quickly, and the Beatles started, and the music started, and the fame started, and the press. And it wasn't a sort of natural, normal husband and wife situation at that time.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite. Murray the K and about 5 beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realized then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No, no. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. You know, I'm not being crude on this, but I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner. And after dinner, he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD. And, of course, it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds. And for me, that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture. And I couldn't cope with it, and I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And, of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug, so he tried it again. And then if you realize at a time like that when there's so much money around and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers, so there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. There were captive audiences to these people who are constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since yep. he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's a division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've, you know, I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home, really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John again was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we were all devastated by Brian's death.
How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her, oh, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start when you saw them together that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the crazy, the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt, an uncle, and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. I mean, because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always. I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Cynthia Lennon speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. Coming up, Yoko Ono. This is Fresh Air.